All right, welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. I am joined by three amigos today. So I am joined by James Allen, Mr. Liam Flynn and Tommy Howes. How is it going, lads?
It's been a while since we've had the full crew together. And now the full crew is even bigger. I can't believe it. Four, man. You're not going to be able to share this screen anymore if we get any more members. Good job, Bissett went premium on the old Zoom account, man. Well done, Bissett.
Are we splitting that, by the way?
Nah.
No chance, man.
On Anchor paying for that.
Yeah. Get the ads. You should host your podcast on Anchor. You can also get free merch.
Oh, they are 1 cent per thousand fucking views or something. Like, listens where it is. I think we're up to about $7 after like 1,500 plays or something, man. It's fucking terrible.
Very excited to be back on the pod. Sorry, I can only apologize to all the listeners dying to hear my hot takes on all the sports, but here I am. I'm back. You can all breathe easy now. And I'm very, very excited to be joining the stage with Mr. Tommy, who's...
I had to come back on because there was one thing in particular that I said last week, which was pretty inaccurate. Should we call it a Tommy Howler? So I thought I needed to come back on here and right some wrongs.
Go on, son, you little howler.
Oh, we're going to have to do a montage of all the Tommy Howlers, like every time you've been on now, like at the end of the year, we'll do a Tommy Howler edition in it and just like clip all your howlers put together. And then all of my like terrible takes, like from since the start of the podcast, which is going to be too many to compile into one episode, I think.
We've all done a few Tommy Howlers, man. Come on. None of us are guilt-free on that front, but I can't believe you just coined your own phrase 10 seconds into the new pod. What an appearance. What a lad.
Got to take ownership of it, haven't you?
And to be fair, Jim, in the, you know, we're talking about howlers. Let's give Jim some credit for absolutely calling that boxing match on the weekend. Because to be honest, we didn't have the feature fight section because I dropped an absolute bollock. But he absolutely called that to a T. So round of applause for Jim, man. Like, you got credit where it's due when we get things right, mate.
I appreciate that a lot. And to be fair, we did the live watch along on the Sunday. But we, like you said before we started recording, we had a good chat about all the fights that were on. And we'll briefly go over it later on. I won't pat myself on the back too much. But I was trying to explain it to Pizzy before about that result. And I could just see Dimitri Bivol like having that kind of success. But we'll get onto that a little bit later. The UFC from last weekend was absolutely sick. Right, there's a couple of memes going on from that, i.e. Michael Chandler's foot to Tony Ferguson's chin, making him look like some sort of 1980s special effects. But yeah, the fights last week were wicked. And this weekend, there's going to be some sick ones and some bizarre ones as well.
Right, let's crack on with the preamble ramble. So this was Tommy Howard's idea. So let's talk about Haaland to City because it's a huge move. And a little bit of a steal, really. Obviously, they've, what do you call it? They have triggered his release clause, which is somewhere in the region of £50 million, I believe. Is this basically City saying, right, we're cementing our dominance for like the next 2 or 3 years? Because they've got Gabriel Jesus, who by no means has had a bad season this year. You know, he's come in and he's done really, really well. I say come in. He's been there for quite a few years now, but he sort of like took over the role that Sergio Aguero sort of left. And they've also got that guy coming back from on loan. I think he's on loan in Argentina or something. He's definitely Argentinian. His name is escaping me. But he's got to come back. So we don't know what he's like yet. So they're going to have him. They're going to have Haaland. They're going to have Gabriel Jesus. They've still got the electric Kevin De Bruyne who scored 4 the other night. Can you really see, is this kind of City cementing their place in the Premier League for the next few years?
Did you say he's worth the buyout clause is 50 million? Because I was reading reports that eventually it's going to cost City like 123. Is that like, how does that work in terms of the initial transfer and, you know?
Yeah, I think the initial fee, so it was reported £51 million, but yeah, no doubt there's going to be some clauses in that contract. So it'll be like after X amount of goals, like you owe us this amount, they'll probably be like, you know, have to pay extra for international appearances. They put all sorts of mad clauses in the contract, man, to try and get more money out of it. But look, so you ain't going to care, are they? Like, it's not like they're short of a few quid. And the more success he brings to City, the better it's going to be for them, to be honest, isn't it?
I've just seen a report that Man City's release clause for Haaland will be 150 million euros. So they've triggered Borussia Dortmund's at 50, and now they've tripled it. So, you know what I mean, if they ever sell him, they're going to be cashing in. But why would they sell him? I mean, if he does what he's done already, I mean, yeah, it's going to be hard to see past them with the league, at least. And then does he add that extra calibre to go on and get a bit further in the Champions League?
Well, I'll throw a hypothetical at you. What if PSG just said, all right, we'll trigger his release clause now? Because is that not a roundabout the fee of what, you know, teams like PSG, Real Madrid, Barcelona probably valued him at? Around about 130 million. That's probably what his market value was. So why don't one of the big clubs that are probably going to pay in the region of that amount anyway, just go and trigger his release clause now? I'm pretty sure they could do that. And then Man City make treble their income on him, or double their income rather. And then, you know, they've still got Gabriel Jesus to play in that position. They've got money to spend on another player. But do they really think that Erling Haaland's going to fit their system? Because for me, he plays well. He played well for Dortmund in more of a counter-attacking system. I think they're a team that like to play quickly, like to play direct, get the ball into his feet. Maybe, you know, he rolls the defender, plays in the wingers, gets into the box. He can score from outside the box. So he's an all-rounded player, but is he really going to fit into the sort of style that Man City play? It'd really be interesting. It's an interesting sort of dynamic that he's going to bring to Man City, and whether he's going to fit. Because you have, as we know, with Lukaku coming from, you know, he was sort of, I don't want to say average at United, but he wasn't, I don't think he really hit the heights that was expected of him at United. Then he went over to Italy and for Inter Milan, and he was good there. And I think he suited that position, and he suited that role that Inter Milan wanted to play, for him to play. And then he came back to Chelsea, and he's been a bit part of player, hasn't he? He hasn't really captured any of that form that he had in Italy. So could you see something like this happening to Haaland?
There's no guarantee that he's going to hit the ground running. Pep certainly seems like confident enough when he was asked about this similar kind of question. Lukaku scored a decent goal the other day in the 6-yard box, holding onto it, holding off defenders, waiting for the very last minute to slam it in.
Holds it.
But that was like a very brief ray of sunshine in a rather rainy season for Lukaku. And I'd be surprised if he's there next season. Haaland, you know me, I'm not sold on this new generation of players that grace the cover of FIFA. Mbappe and Haaland have been the two shining examples of that. Vinicius Jr. as well, before his Champions League exploits this year, pretty much sold on him now. I think Haaland's got the physical presence to like not be overawed by defenders. But the thing is, the game's a bit different now, isn't it? Like, that physicality is less of a factor than it would have been, say, 10 years ago. And as for City's style of play, they score quite a lot of headers, you know. Like, they basically take all the defenders out of the game and then lift one over to the back post. Sterling, Silva, De Bruyne. Players get on the end of that. I think he'd be perfect in that kind of scenario.
Well, I think Benzema would be a great fit for Manchester City in the way they play. Because I think they like strikers that can time their run perfectly into the box, because all of their play, and I think it was Patrice Evra who criticised Pep Guardiola as a coach midweek. And he was saying that he coaches like he's playing the PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5 or whatever, meaning that he kind of, the way he sets his team up, and it's kind of like they're robotic. Like he wants their players to be robotic and play to a certain tempo and play these set plays where it's kind of like, right, pass goes into X goes to Y. So it's always like in a certain pattern. And I feel like Haaland wouldn't suit that as someone like Benzema. I know Benzema is what, you know, he's only been around for a couple of years, hasn't he? So like he hasn't really been at that playing at that at the high levels for like
unproven.
Unproven player. So I don't know how he'd do in the Premier League. Now, but I do think that he would suit Man City's system, or a player like him would suit more than Haaland. Obviously, this is probably going to be another horrible take. He's going to go and score 40 goals next year. But yeah, I think 21 years old, he's got his career ahead of him. Obviously, born in England, born in Leeds. So he's an English boy at heart. So, you know, I hope he does well, man. I do honestly hope he does well. But it would just be interesting to see how Guardiola fits him into that Manchester City system. Right, should we have a quick word on Coutinho getting his permanent move to Villa after a, I would say successful. You'd have to say successful, isn't it? Loan spell. Obviously, Tommy Howells was at the Villa game on Tuesday, was it, against Liverpool? So we'll get his take on how good he was in to see in person. I know he really hit the ground running for Villa, didn't he? Scored. He was getting goals, assists in his first few games, and everybody was like absolutely going mad over him. But he's been fairly quiet, I'd say, over the last month or so. How did you find his performance, Tommy?
To be fair, I didn't notice him on the pitch until probably 20 minutes in.
Strongbow.
Yeah, there was a few strongbows sunk before, and I was just soaking in the atmosphere. Like, Villa Park was rocking. It was a big game. Liverpool, obviously, fantastic team. So just on sort of the visuals of it, Coutinho didn't really grab my attention early on. So I don't know if that's a comment on him or me. Coutinho, I've always rated him. He was class at Liverpool. He didn't really set the world alight at Barcelona the way that some people would have expected. But, I mean, there was a big price tag associated with him and a lot of pressure going to a club like Barcelona, where he's maybe a little bit more under the radar at Liverpool. And, I mean, he's a great player. He's scored some fantastic goals. And I enjoy watching him. Like, he's, if you look at his highlight reel, he scored some absolute screamers. So I think it's a good signing for Villa. And it shows intent of the direction that they want to go. Obviously, Gerrard, manager, holds a lot of sort of power with players and stuff. And who else are they bringing? I mean, I spoke to Stitch a few months ago, and he was talking about the potential for Luis Suarez to join as well. And I mean, if that happened, that would be pretty impressive considering where Villa were a couple of years ago.
Hopefully Stitch's rumours are more solid than Tino's rumours of Diego Costa coming to the Blues.
That Luis Suarez one's been around for a while, hasn't it? I think we were talking about this on the pod a good while ago.
Yeah, we broke that story, mate.
We broke that story. Yeah, it was some journalist, I think here in Spain, there was some journalist who said he was good mates with Suarez and he had it on good authority that he wants to go to Villa. But I don't know, that was a while ago, but that would be pretty cool.
But when people make these sweeping, like, oh yeah, like they used to chill back in the day, or like his agent's Spanish, like, and there's someone Spanish at Villa, so that must mean that they're gonna get together, innit? And they're gonna
he
sign.
Just knows another dude called Suarez.
Yeah, nothing to do with Louis. Yeah, Suarez is going, bro. Yeah, next week. Yeah.
But did you see Coutinho's first game with Villa, Tommy Howells? I think it was it the one against Man U? And you come on like the 70th minute or something.
Yeah, he took things on. And did he score a goal and an assist, was it?
I mean, he might have scored two, did he? Maybe.
I think he just scored the one. I think, was it 2-1 in the end, that one, or? Maybe he scored two.
No, yeah, I forgot about that, as you would, as a United fan. So
screwing Tommy. I was speaking to Pizzy last weekend as well, and he was saying, like, after a spectacular start, kind of like a middling player. Like, they do end up worshipping players down there at the Villa, and John McGinn being one example. And it speaks volumes to me that, like, Pizzy, long-term, like, diehard Villa fan, in his mind, didn't really seem to be much question as to who he'd prefer to have in that team. But a player of Coutinho's quality can only, like you say, Tommy, elevate a team like Villa. And if they can get like more like trademark names around him on the back of Gerrard, that would be so sick for him. But they seem to be safe earlier on in the season. And they've got an unlikely chance, haven't they, still, of going down. And that's kind of indicative of their late season slip after kind of bouncing over the Christmas period. It's been a little bit precarious for Villa, but not as precarious as for some of the other teams, man. Like Leeds in particular, like they've been sliding hard lately, man.
Yeah, and we'll get onto that just in a sec. I was looking at the you got 4 goals, 3 assists in 14 appearances so far for Villa with 2 games left. But the last sort of 7-8 games, no goal, no assist. Who scored? He hasn't got a rating of over 6.5. So quite a few low ratings there, 5.96. Mind you, he only got 10 minutes there against Burnley. That's a game Villa won. And So yeah, he hasn't quite recaptured that brilliant form he had at the start when he first was started at Villa and he came on loan. So, but I think, you know, now he's going to be a permanent fixture. I think they can build around him. They could probably get in maybe an extra couple of players that, and they can work their system around the way he plays, because he's such a, you know, you get him on the ball, he makes things happen. Do you know what I mean? You need to make sure you give him the ball, give him a chance to do his flair stuff. He's not always going to come off, right? He's going to be a risk-reward player where, you know, he can put the ball in from 35 yards, but, you know, maybe sort of like 7 times out of 10, the ball's going to go, you know, into Rosette or whatever. But I think he'll be a good signing for Villa next season.
How much do you think Villa paid for him?
I think it was about 20 million euros, wasn't it? So I did read that it was like
cheap.
I think Barcelona paid 120 odd for him, and he only made 76 appearances for Barcelona in 4 years. So that is a horrendous loss of investment, to be honest, which is really, really bad. But that's not uncommon for Barcelona, is it, in the last few years?
No, they've been pissing money up the wall like no one's business, but they've actually been turning it around in the league, man. All hail Xavi. The king of Barca returns, man. What a legend.
All right, so we'll go over the title race. So we'll talk about the title race. Let's focus on the top of the table first. Now we've got, what, 2 games left. I think Man City and Liverpool got 2 games each left to play. One of them being Villa. I think Man City got to go there at home to Villa last game of the season. I think, who have Liverpool got to play? Somebody check that real quick. They've both got 2 fixtures left. Man City have obviously got the advantage on the goal difference standpoint. Can you see Man City slipping up?
You don't look too convinced, man. Little shake of the head, little grimace. Since they got knocked out of the Champions League, they seem to have been turning the screw quite tight in the Premier League. At the same time, as Liverpool have been fielding less dangerous squads in the league, Tommy mentioned earlier about they put in probably not a second string team for the Villa game, but certainly not their strongest. We're beginning to see where their priorities are beginning to lie. You know, I start to feel like because Man City's got the league in hand, Liverpool might be content to prioritise the Champions League final. I don't know if anyone else gets that impression.
Yeah, I think that's credit to both teams. Man City, from the standpoint of they just suffered that like huge mental sort of, how can I say, deficit really from that losing that Champions League tie against Real Madrid, being basically having the final like in the palm of your hands, and then, you know, letting it slip away through your fingers in like the last couple of minutes, where really Real Madrid weren't threatening too much throughout the whole game. Then they, you know, they take it to extra time, and then obviously Benzema scores that penalty to take them through to the final. So to come back from that sort of mental attrition from that, and then putting the performance that they did against Newcastle, I thought was fantastic. It really just shows the sort of elite level of competition competitive players that are in that squad, and then being able to bounce back from that adversity. Because like, you could see, all right, they've just suffered that big loss. You know, the morale's low in the dressing room. You know, maybe they labour to a 1-0 win, or they draw 0-0 or 1-1. You know, they make a couple of mistakes. But now they went and absolutely dismantled Newcastle 5-0. And then they beat Wolves midweek.
5 past Wolves as well.
I mean, look at that. They scored 10 goals in 2 games. It doesn't really matter who the opposition is. 2 Premier League games, they're never going to be easy. To bounce back after that Champions League loss, I thought was fantastic. And then same again for Liverpool. Obviously, they had the draw against Spurs on the weekend. And then they had that 2-1 win against Villa while rotating players as well. That shows you how much Klopp trusts the squad that he's got there. So I think both of those teams, you have to give massive credit to. And they are, by and large, like the best 2 Premier Leagues in the Premier League by a fucking really big margin, to be honest.
Do you reckon the best 2 Premier League teams ever?
In terms of them both being good at the same time, so in terms of them bringing the best out of each other, I would say probably, yeah. I can't remember. Obviously, you've got Arsenal, Man United of the sort of, you know, mid-2000s to like sort of 2010, where there was a little bit of like strong competition. And then Chelsea were in and about there at the same time. But in terms of quality and in terms of like the coaches that are there, you've got 2 of the best coaches in the world coaching these 2 teams. I'd probably round rival with that sort of Man United Arsenal sort of Wenger and Ferguson era. What do you think, Jim?
Roy Keane Vieira as well. That's that was a big sort of thing. That incident in the tunnel kind of epitomised the rivalry between those two teams, and just the hatred between them. And you don't really get that as much in modern day football, I don't think, because everyone's sort of taught to speak to the press, and it's like a breath of fresh air when someone actually says what they think.
Yeah, in the tunnel where right after the bus stop, like Keane thinks Vieira's bullying someone. And he's like, I see out there, like glaring out onto the pitch, like he's about to do some damage. That's like that was like the last of the old school football, wasn't it, really? Because towards the end of the 2000s, everything got a bit pussified. And I think if I'm being completely honest, that rivalry was quite one-sided in Man U's favour. You know, there were a few famous examples of rebuttals, like was it 98 when Arsenal won the title at Old Trafford, and it's like instances like that were like pretty big for a few years, but over the breadth of their rivalry, it was pretty one-sided. So I think in terms of, like you're saying, Bissett, two teams being this equally matched, like we've had close title races before, you know, this is 3 points in it going down to the final. Football's like so much more technical now, but it's also kind of, I don't know if it's nostalgia. It might be something to do with what you were saying about Pep being like a football manager, computerized type guy. It's almost like a little bit sterile. Do you know what I mean? So it's hard to compare eras, but in terms of technicality and in terms of fitness and in terms of tactical awareness, in terms of coverage and replays and all that, it's pretty hard to argue with this current era in the title race.
Yeah, I think you that's a great point, Jim. I think the game has become a lot more technical. Obviously, you've got the improvements with, you know, the pitches are like far more advanced. Like they're playing on a carpet now compared to some of the grounds you had to play on in sort of like the late 90s, early 2000s, where it was just like a mud bath. So that's changed the aspect of how the game's played. And there's also a different mentality, as Tommy said, like in terms of like players, you know, essentially wanting to hurt other players more than they were wanting to actually play the game. And Dean Saunders was on TalkSport, who I always think chaps are absolute shit. And I think TalkSport have become this kind of meme place, absolute memes, man. Like, right. It's just, they get people on just to talk absolute nonsense just so they can get likes. He was saying, he was questioning whether De Bruyne would have been as good in Roy Keane's era. Because he was like, oh, Roy Keane would just smash him. Roy Keane would just like, he'd go in for the tackle, going for a tackle, and he'd leave him in a heap in the first 5 minutes. He wouldn't want to play after that. And I was thinking, I mean, that's just absolute nonsense, man. I think Roy Keane gets his like bad image because of probably the Erling Haaland tackle, where basically ended his career, and then he subsequently said in his autobiography that he actually meant to do it. But I think he gets his bad image. But Roy Keane was actually a good, like, technical footballer as well. And he was a leader. He wasn't just like a thug. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like they were like, it's not like going back to the 70s and 80s where they could literally kick shit out of each other on the field and the referee wouldn't say anything. So I don't agree with what Dean sort of was saying. But yeah, the game's changed in terms of like technical ability for sure. And it's become like fast paced. It's become more about 1-2 touch football, positional play, off the ball movement. It's become a lot more focused on that than it has on sort of individual brilliance of like being able to dribble or being able to, you know, or the crowd, like when you get a tackle, like everyone's fucking cheering one challenge. You know what I mean? It has changed slightly.
I'll tell you what's a good example of that. The Leeds player that went in two-footed, was it on Kovacic in the Chelsea game? And they're calling it a horror tackle, like absolutely disgusting. That was standard in the early 90s, like late 80s.
Was it Luke Ayling? Was he the guy that got sent off?
I think so. Yeah, straight red, no question about it. Like the way people are viewing it is like horrendous, horrendous. But it's like, have you ever seen Graham Souness's highlight reel? When he starts criticising people on how to play football, it's like, mate, I've never seen you kick a ball. You just used to be smashing into people's kneecaps. It's just it's a whole different thing, man. And probably better as well for like player longevity, etc. But yeah, that was an example of how the game has moved on, definitely in the past few years. And it didn't even save them because they've been getting hammered left, right, and centre recently, Leeds.
Well, they're in 3-4, aren't they? And I think they've got two games left. The two teams around them have got an extra game in hand. Leeds got to play Brighton at home, and Brentford away. So two winnable games for sure. Everton have also got to play Brentford at home. They got Palace at home. Then they got Arsenal away last game of the season. I'm not sure who Burnley have got as their last three remaining fixtures, but it's just not looking good for Leeds. They need to win both of those games really to guarantee their safety. And Everton are in the ascendancy. Burnley have won three of the last four, was it? I think they got beat last time out, didn't they? On the weekend, or was it midweek? I think they got beat. So, you know, you can just see, you can see Burnley fighting to the end. I think it's going to be maybe 4 points.
Burnley have got Tottenham, Aston Villa and Newcastle in the last three.
They've probably got the hardest run in. Obviously, yeah, they've only got beat 3-1 by Villa. And then, yeah, that was it. So they got three games left. You just can't see it. I can't see. Can you see Leeds getting out of that? Who do you think is going to go down?
Yeah, Leeds, man. I've been saying it for a few weeks. You're American, Breda. Not doing enough to save the sinking ship. But it's we've always said, but we fancy Burnley, don't we? And even though Everton had a prolonged shaky period, they've been pulling results out of their arse left, right and centre. So even though, was it last time out, they had a last time Newcastle, they've lost two now. Burnley have lost the last one. Everton drew the last one. Yeah, I'd say, yeah, you got to say Leeds, don't you? You fancy Burnley in that situation with the game in hand as well. But it's hard to say. I don't know, man. I'm torn because I could see Everton having an absolute shit show like next time out because they've been so up and down. Maybe a few scoreless draws, but I'll stick with Leeds.
Yeah, I think Leeds as well. Long time listeners to the podcast, so I was completely bought in on the Everton take. And then after you sort of spoke about it for a few weeks, it seemed like they just started winning every game. But yeah, I think Leeds are probably done, aren't they?
Nails. I think you can credit us with them pulling it back.
They should sponsor us. We lit the fires of competition under their asses, man. Long-time listener, Frank Lampard, friend of the pod.
And we slagged him off. We slagged his tactics off and then he started winning games. That's it. That's how it goes, really, with the ball chat takes.
He literally went four at the back after you started caning him for it.
He did. he fully did. He'd been listening.
But yeah, so I think we're all in agreement. I don't think Leeds are going to have the minerals to get themselves out of that. It's going to be a shame for Jesse Marsh because he's not going to bring any solace to the US over here and sort of wanting him to do well. So it gives them a better image in terms of their sort of perception of the game and stuff. I think that's a big thing over here. I think I spoke to a few of the coaches this week. Was over at the Red Bull Turf facility and they were saying like, you know, we really want Leeds to stay up because I think it gives a good image of the sort of American football game. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, but he looks like he's going to go down, but he might stay there. I wouldn't be surprised if Leeds keep him on. They seem like they're going along that route.
What, in your opinion, do they need to do to not go down? As you know, if your fellow American coach came over to you and he's like, Bissett, I'm trying to run Leeds, we're going down, what should I do? What would you tell him?
Apart from stating the obvious that they need to win two games, but how do they need to win two games?
Yeah.
Don't be shit. That's what you need to do.
Well, they're not doing themselves any favours with these red cards and like they can't seem to keep the ball out of the net at the minute and they're not scoring goals either. I just don't know. I don't know if they've got the squad to be able to get out of it now. They've been dogged with injuries all season. I think Calvin Phillips is back now, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's been a big miss from all season. He's probably contributed to a lot of the fact of why they haven't been successful. But Bamford as well, I think they've missed him through injury quite a lot this year as well. But he doesn't seem to really have, when he has been in the team, hit any of the heights that he had last season. I think he scored quite a few goals last year. And he doesn't seem to have been on the score sheet much at all. I'm just looking at the latest lineup against Chelsea. Quite a few youth players in there. Rodrigo, who I think has been sort of like hot and cold all season. Nah, I just think, it was Daniel James that got sent off, by the way. It wasn't Luke Ayling. I think he might have been sent off in another game. He might have been suspended for that game because he doesn't look like he's in the lineup, but yeah, man, I just don't know. I just don't think they've got the personnel to be able to pull it out their arse.
that Rodrigo was going nuts against the referee as well after that tackle. Like, had to be held back by his teammates, completely lost the head. And that's like indicative of where the squad's at the minute. Rash challenge, red card straight. Another player's about to get sent off for screwing at the ref. They're at sixes and sevens, mate. The Ant can't help them. Arsenal put a nail in their coffin as well. Sunday, the 8th, mate. And
talking about Arsenal. I was going to say, don't avoid it, mate, because that result was what? Was it yesterday, Wednesday night? Wednesday night?
3-0 to Spurs. Rob Holding with an egregious elbow to the face of Son as he's like throwing on goal. Cedric giving away a penalty. I said the other week, he's a liability, man. But yeah, to be fair, I can't... If you take out of the context of the top four race, which obviously can't because we're getting down to the wire now, this is the first result in a good few weeks where you're like, oh, Arsenal have absolutely flopped it there. But Spurs have been on the ascendancy before now. As I've just mentioned, beat Leeds 2-1, beat West Ham 2-1, beat Man United 3-1 and beat Chelsea 4-2. That's a good run of games. A lot of points in the bag there, a crucial stage. I don't feel comfortable like bollocking Arsenal for losing 3-0 away at Spurs. It was just a regression to the same kind of irresponsible defensive decisions. It's almost as if they were trying to be overly aggressive, but because they're not a defensive, like hard-hitting team, they didn't have the guile. They didn't have the little sneaky moves. They were just elbowing left, right and centre, trying to be physical with, let's be honest, Kane and Son. They're like physical players themselves. Like, you're not going to do that to them too. And especially the pace they move the ball and the weight. Yeah, they were just completely outgunned. And it doesn't help when you've got 10 men after about 20 minutes.
Outgunned. The gun is outgunned. But to be fair, they've still got it. It's still in their hand. Their own fate is still in their own hands, isn't it? Because I think they've still got that point advantage. And two games left, they've just got to beat Newcastle and Everton. Newcastle away and Everton home. Like, if they want that fourth place and they truly feel like they deserve it, you've got to win those last two games. And then you're there. Champions League football for the first time in what, 5 years? 5-6 years? When was the last time they had Champions League football?
A good long while now. I couldn't put a number on it. It's got to be at least 5 years. But as we've mentioned, I don't like the look of that Everton game. And hand on heart, each year's, based on what we know of Arsenal, do you think they can hold their nerve in those last two games?
No chance.
Mate, you said Arsenal were going to get top four a few weeks ago, Flynn. You can't turn cloak now.
Oh, man, I'm fickle as fuck.
I think Arsenal will finish fourth. I think they'll win those last two games and I think they'll finish fourth.
I don't think they will, because just from doing the pod with you guys over the last few weeks, all I hear about them is they never pull it out when it's needed. So they just get smashed by much weaker teams on the reg. And then who did they beat recently there, Jim? I mean, you couldn't believe it.
United and Chelsea, one game after the other, man. It's like, what's going on?
What's wrong with this team?
Yeah, after three defeats against Palace, Brighton and Southampton, like games that you shouldn't really be losing if you're on about getting into the Champions League. And then that run. And then, like, you know, eking out results. A weird one at West Ham, two set pieces. You never see that either. But, this one at Tottenham sent the alarm bells ringing for me. What about you, Tommy? What's your impression of this final run-in for Arsenal?
Well, I was just looking at Tottenham's fixtures. And I think, well, what is it? It's Burnley and Norwich. So, Norwich, 3 points. Burnley, I mean, yeah, probably 3 points. But they are fighting to stay out of the relegation zone, so they've got a lot to play for. But yeah, Arsenal for a while have sort of not achieved those goals. Well, as you say, they've not been in Champions League for five odd years, so it'd be a really good achievement for them to get there. Newcastle have had a bit of a dip in form recently, haven't they? But generally one of the in-form, like for the last, well, 10 games, are more of an in-form team in the Premier League. And then Everton, another team that are battling relegation. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. I think it could go either way. I'll sit on the fence on this one.
God damn it, Tommy.
Tottenham, fourth place for sure. You heard it here first.
You're a little bitch as well.
Think about what both Arsenal and Tottenham are up against next. Tottenham's against two teams fighting relegation, whereas Arsenal's only against one fighting relegation. So even though they're like super weak teams, they're going to be going for it. So yeah.
So that means Arsenal.
Yeah, that means Arsenal will get it. Yeah.
So cool. But still, you at your own point there.
But still, Tottenham top four for sure.
But you know that those are the Burnley game for Tottenham and the Everton game for Arsenal are quite similar in that they're going to be scrapping for their lives. I think Tottenham will obliterate Norwich because everyone's been smashing them to bits.
Yeah, they're down. They've been down for a few weeks. Like, there's no way Norwich get anything out of that game. So basically, it's automatic 3 points for Tottenham. And then Burnley, who I just think they're going to have far too much firepower for. Obviously, Son Heung-min, who we've been really bigging up on this podcast over the last sort of like couple of months, really. He's only one goal off. I guess it's Mo Salah, who's on 22 goals. And then I think it's Son Heung-min on 21. So he could be top goal scorer. He could get the golden boot. And obviously, there's going to be questions about whether he should be involved in the conversation for the PFA Player of the Year. I think that's going to go to De Bruyne, especially after him scoring 4 goals the other day. And he's won it the last 2 years. So I guess he'd probably be one of the, I've done if any other players won it 3 times on a trot, but it just shows you the amount of quality that Man City have got and how good he is, really. But we'll talk about the FA Cup final. Obviously, Liverpool have got their 2-week period where, you know, they're either going to finish the season with 1 trophy or 4 trophies, isn't it? So it's a huge game for them on Saturday. Or Sunday, is it? Saturday or Sunday? It'll be on the weekend. I think it might be Saturday. They're up against Chelsea. They beat Man City in the first half, really, in the semi-final, didn't they? It was 3-0. Man City got 2 goals in the second half, one being quite late. But they were absolutely exhilarating in that semi-final against Man City. How do you see this one playing out? Because Chelsea haven't really been in any kind of form lately. They beat Leeds, didn't they, midweek 3-0. But prior to that, they'd hit a bit of a, you know, they've been stumbling a little bit. I think Rudiger's on his way to Real Madrid, isn't he? Lukaku's sort of been out of sorts. How do you see this one going?
Well, they battered City in that game in the semi-final. I don't care if it was 3-2. They were absolutely all over them. Difficult to say because Chelsea weren't the most convincing in the FA Cup semi-final either. Well, was it 2-0 against Palace? It was all right, but it wasn't like setting the world on fire. It's hard to say because surely now City have got to be favoured for the league. I kind of favour Liverpool just on that kind of trying to get one over on them, trying to claw a little bit of ground back, adding to the fact that they've reached the Champions League semi-final. I could see them wanting to kind of right a few wrongs that have occurred in the league. But I can also see Chelsea trying to rectify the end of their season, which, as you've said, has been underwhelming to say the least. They've been dropping points left and right. The Lukaku situation is questionable. They've got a for Tommy Tuchel, long time friend of the pod. I think he's gonna be quite aggressive in terms of his motivation towards his team because this is all they've got now. And Liverpool have got other options, haven't they? They've got the big one, and this is all Chelsea have got to play for.
That's a good point from a sort of game or load management, as they call it in the NBA, or periodization perspective in terms of keeping players fresh for important games. How does Klopp approach this game? Does he put out his so-called B team, even though, you know, their B teams are better than most teams in the world, A team? But would he rotate players? Would he maybe rest Salah? Would he maybe rest, probably Jordan Henderson? Which player, Andy Robertson, perhaps. So which players does he rest? Does he put out a full-strength team, or do you think he goes with a sort of like a weakened side for the FA Cup final and then, you know, puts all his eggs in the basket for trying to win the Premier League and then focusing on that Champions League final at the end of May?
Would you jeopardise the Champions League final for the FA Cup final?
I'd go all out for all of them. Put on a show for everyone.
No, there's 2 weeks between the FA Cup. Sorry, Flynn.
There's
2 weeks
right
between the FA Cup and the Champions League final. So, provided there's no horrific injuries you'd say 2 weeks is a reasonable amount of time to recover from something like a niggle potentially. I'm of the opinion that they're not really in the race for the Premier League anymore. Now, does Klopp say, we've got two cup finals and that's our season? Southampton is on Tuesday, so it's quite soon after the FA Cup final. So he might see that as a way to rotate some players in. So it's Southampton and Wolves left in the league. I would be, as a, I don't know, for a club, the history is written by the winners. If you win the cup, your name's on that cup and no one else's. So to me, I would be saying, we've got two cup finals and that's going to basically, it's a treble. It's not got the Premier League in it, but it's a treble winning season.
Can't disagree with that.
I like your logic there, Tommy. I like your logic.
How possible is it for Liverpool to win the league? Three points behind at the minute.
Yeah, they have to win both games and hope that Man City slip up in one of theirs.
Well, and the goal difference is massive now as well. There's like seven goals in it. So they're going to have to absolutely smash their opponents. And Man City have come off the back of two games where they scored five goals in each game. Like, Man City not going to score any goals as well. Like, I just don't see, apart from a massive upset, I don't see the league really being a possibility for Liverpool anymore.
I'm sold. I am sold. Go on, Tommy.
So Liverpool win the treble. They obviously, they've already won the League Cup. So they go and win the FA Cup on Saturday. Then they win the Champions League on the 31st. Is that what you're thinking?
I didn't say they were going to beat Real Madrid. I'm just saying they've got two chances.
But I tell you what, though, just as a little precursor to the future, who would you fancy in that Champions League final? Because Real Madrid, I don't even think they're anywhere near as good as the top level Real Madrid teams that we've seen over the last decade. But they're somehow in the final, beating City after two ridiculous legs of football in the semis, where they've literally, Big Karim, that inexperienced striker, who knew where he come from, that he's just literally steered that team, him and Vinicius Jr., scoring crucial goals in crucial situations. It's not quite Liverpool 05, but it's that kind of thing, isn't it? They're not dominating games. They're scoring when they need to sometimes at the last minute. So would you favour that, their kind of magical run to the final, or would you favour Liverpool's more consistent approach where, aside from like 50 minutes of not being able to score against Villarreal, they've been absolutely ruthless in the Champions League?
To be fair, though, Jim, we say like they're not the team they used to be. They still finished 12 points ahead of Barcelona at the top of La Liga. And has to be said, Barcelona are not the team they used to be either. But you still got Atletico Madrid, who are miles off the pace like that this season as well. Like, they finished 5 points behind Barca. So I don't think the Spanish league has really, depleted that much in terms of quality and competition. So I don't know, maybe just because Real Madrid with the Galacticos has set such high standards of itself over the years that we're thinking, right, Real Madrid are, they're not quite the team they used to be, but mate, they're still an extremely formidable team. I think, you know, obviously you were saying earlier, Vinicius Jr., like what a player he's turned into. Benzema's playing probably the best football he's ever played at the minute. They've still got Luka Modric in there. They've still got Toni Kroos in there. Very, very high caliber players. So it's going to be a tough one for Liverpool. That's going to be their hardest game, without a doubt, over the next 2 weeks. So I think that Klopp will be keeping that in the back of his mind at all times in terms of like rotating players and load management. So I still think if Liverpool play their best team and they play the way they have been over the last sort of 18 months, they can beat Real Madrid on that day. So I think that Klopp will have that sort of like, you know, targeted in his mind. We can win that game, I think, for sure. So I think even if they do the double and they win the League Cup and the Champions League, what an amazing season that'll be for Liverpool yet again.
We are taking it for granted that they are just going to steamroll everyone. And there's always a chance they might not. I mean, could you imagine Chelsea just smash them, Real smash them, and then Southampton just like obliterate them?
Just beat them, or just like snuck a 1-0 win. No, but, and also, there's the confidence issue as well. If they did lose that cup final 3-1, 3-0, you know, we spoke about Man City and them dealing with adversity after that semi-final defeat. Like, but not every team's going to have that sort of like makeup. You know what I mean? There's other teams that are going to be affected differently. So you never know, man, if they do lose that final 3-1, is that going to have a knock-on effect in terms of their morale and confidence in the dressing room? You just don't really know. But neither of those teams strike me as being a team that's gonna like you know, sort of like fold when it comes to the big game situation. So we'll move on to the five things you might have missed anyway. So round off the football chat there. And we'll actually, no, before that, we'll do a bit of an NFL chat. So Tommy, you can redeem yourself. I know the NFL fixtures came out yesterday. There was some pretty hilarious release moments from a few teams. I think it was LA Chargers being the best one, where they did like a 2-minute anime with loads of references to various different anime shows, which I thought was incredible. Did you also notice the week 3 one as well? It was the Jacksonville Jaguars coach who was like, basically had his thumb up some bird's bum hole. Remember that? We broke that story on the pod as well. I keep on putting you on the spot here, mate, don't you? I'm not doing you any favours, Mr. McAvoy. Urban Meyer, that's it, yeah.
My search history is going to look weird after that one.
And it, thumb up some birds by mole.
NFL coach, finger ass.
Finger ass. Well, it's only two extra words from what you're usually typing in, isn't it, Flynn, to be fair?
But I said I wasn't going to ask you. I said I was going to ask you, and then you were like, "Nah, probably don't ask me." But I'm going to ask you anyway, Tommy. So, which team do you think has possibly, you know, benefited the most from the ease of their schedule, and potentially might be an outside sort of contender to make the playoffs that perhaps wouldn't have been otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult thing to say at this stage. I haven't looked at all of the schedules that have been released. So yeah, I did say don't ask me this question. But it's fine. I think one of the things when it comes to schedules and the way you look at them is teams can be very different to how they were the year before. So what might look like an easy schedule at the start of the season can evolve into a kind of more tricky one and a bit of a difficult one, depending on how those teams, like coaching changes, personnel changes, rookies that have come in, like one season to the next can have quite a big change. Like if you look at the way that some teams, like the Bengals before last year, like were not considered one of the sort of better teams, and then they've gone on to a Super Bowl. And I see a few places where that could happen, like the Dolphins and the Jets, the Lions. These are all teams that for the last few seasons haven't been performing, but they've been making substantial changes with coaching staff as well as player personnel, that sort of towards the end of next season, we could be saying, well, only a few more things and they're contending for a Super Bowl next year.
I'm shocked that you put Jets into that category though. Yeah, they were pretty woeful. Apart from that sort of little 2 or 3 week period where Mike White came in, and he just like lit the place up. I think he had a couple of really good performances, and then he's sort of like gone on to basically nothing now. I think Zach Wilson's going to be their QB1 going into the new season. I have been hearing on the radio, because I listen to a lot of ESPN, they just talk all about the New York sports teams. They were talking about Zach Wilson coming back and being like basically like beefcake. Like he's come back from the gym and he's like absolutely stacked. And they're saying how that might be a key factor in terms of like, oh, he's Nev's on the steads. But that might be a factor of him coming in and maybe being a different quarterback, because they were talking about how sort of slight he was. And it's never ideal when you're a quarterback that can't deal with the physicality of the league.
Yeah, Zach Wilson was taken second overall in the draft last year. So he's got a lot of draft capital put into them. And NFL teams will work to make sure that these players who they've invested highly in, because when you take a player, the higher you take a player at the draft, the more money you're paying them in their rookie contract. So you're making a commitment to them. I don't think the Jets' offensive line was particularly good, and I think they've made some quite significant trades in order to strengthen that, to give Zach that pass protection, to allow him, give him a little bit longer to make the decision and make the pass.
If you were gonna pick a player. You got Zach Wilson, you got Justin Fields in Chicago. Which quarterback do you see having the better season out of those two?
I think Zach Wilson is in a much better position to take the next step up. I listened to a few podcasts that talk about NFL, and it sounds like the Bears haven't really put Justin Fields in a position to succeed. Which is a shame because he's obviously a very talented quarterback, and you hope that he's not going to be sort of sacrificed to the NFL gods because you need to protect quarterbacks. This is something that's fundamental. If you've got a star quarterback, but they've not got time to make any decisions, and they're just getting thrown to the floor every like five or six plays.
Andrew Luck brings the luck brings mine. Yeah, isn't he, Tommy? 29 years old. Yeah. He got injured. You know, he just took so much punishment. He had to finish his career at 29. Great quarterback when he came into the league, but as you say, like they just didn't find the protection around him to be able to, you know, to be able to really give him a chance to succeed.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how do they, because I always found this really weird and I still don't understand it. How do the NFL determine who plays who? Obviously, they play the teams in their little mini division twice. Yeah. So you've got four teams in each division. What is it, 16 teams in each conference? So they're all broken up into four groups of four. So this is mainly just for Jim and Flynn sort of reference. How do they go about deciding who they play in the other nine games it is now, because it's a 17 game season? How do they decide who they play? Because sometimes you'll see, oh, you know, Chicago Bears haven't played Atlanta Falcons for 9 years, and it's like, how the fuck do they figure out who to, like, you know, because surely, like, if they are just saying, oh, like, they haven't played each other for a while, that's kind of like, is that not sort of deliberately giving teams chances to succeed?
Yeah, no, it's a question I have as well, actually. I'm not 100% sure on the way that they make those decisions. Obviously, yeah, you've got your divisions. As you said, you've got four teams in that division. So you play the other three teams twice in the year. And then they probably try and give you a few more games against your conference. So you've got the AFC and the NFC. And I think they probably try and give you a few more games against the same teams in your conference, but then they do pepper in a few from the opposite conference. But as I say, I'm not 100% sure on actually what they do to make those decisions. But I guess if you parallel it to like the Premier League, where you play every team twice in that league, it wouldn't really be feasible. There's 32 teams in the NFL, and it's a pretty brutal sport. So if you had to sort of do it that way, it just wouldn't be feasible for the number of teams. So I think it's fairly fair. And over the course of a few years, you might have an easier schedule and you might have a tougher schedule. But one thing that's always going to determine the difficulty of your season is the teams in your division. Because if you're in a really tough division, you're going to have six tough games, regardless of who else you're playing. So I think the division can play a big part in a team's ability to then go on and be successful.
And I think your Buffalo Bills probably, you know, that's turned into one of the more difficult divisions in the NFL at the minute. Obviously, Miami Dolphins are looking like they're going to be improving. The New York Jets looking like they're going to be improving. Then the Pats are just the Pats. Like, as long as Bill Belichick's there, they're going to be competitive. So I think that is a really difficult division, because I think when I first started out following the Bears, the NFC North was considered probably one of the most difficult divisions on that conference. So obviously you've got the Vikings, Detroit Lions, who have been pretty poor, but then you've got Green Bay and Chicago. So when Chicago were, you know, okay under Jay Cutler, they were okay for a couple of years, but even before that, like, Green Bay have been good since I've been following the sport. They've always been a successful team, and the Vikings were pretty good around that time as well. So the only real weak link was Detroit Lions. So how do you see, you know, your Buffalo Bills doing? What's their record this season?
Well, yeah. So I've gone through the Bills schedule, and maybe in future weeks we can go through the Bears and the Atlanta Falcons, because I know Jim Allen, you know what I mean? He's all for the Falcons. Or was it Ravens or Cardinals? Was it Chip?
The Eagles, I reckon.
Oh, the Eagles, yeah.
The Montana Grizzly Eagles. That's me, mate.
These divisions, just a quick question about the divisions. Are they done like geographically? Because so you mentioned Chicago's with Detroit, and then New York's with New England Patriots. Is it?
I think that's the intention, but I have seen people do other versions of it, which would be a much more geographical. So it's kind of a bit random, as well as being sort of having some intent.
Yeah, because the Giants and the Jets, both in New York, both play their games at the MetLife, yet they're not in the same division. And sometimes they don't, well, they don't play each other four or five years, do they? The Jets and the Giants, I'm pretty sure.
Are they in the same conference?
Nah. Well, yeah, I'd assume they are in the same conference, but them being in that same not in the same division, for me, doesn't make any sense because I'm not sure about the Chargers and the Rams. Are they in the same division? But mind you, that was St. Louis Rams, yeah. And that might be down to it as well because teams franchise in the NFL, so they won't stay in their city. They'll move to different cities. Obviously, Oakland Raiders as well, being one that have bounced around a lot. So, yeah, that might be part of it as well.
Yeah, so the Giants are in the NFC and the Jets are in the AFC.
So they're in different conferences, which makes absolutely zero sense. Zero sense.
This is a real stumbling block for newcomers to the sport because this seems like it's needlessly complicated.
Like, that's why it's so brilliant as well.
Part of the appeal. Good man, Tommy. Yeah, man. Going to bat for your sport.
Well, we'll round up the NFL stuff with picking Liam Flynn an NFL team to follow this year. Obviously, the regular season starts in about 5 months. So I do feel like NFL are basically like blue balling us with like releasing these fixtures and it like, oh, yeah, OK, these are the fixtures. You're going to have to wait for you're going to have to wait 5 months for it, though. So we're going to pick an NFL team for Flynn. So have you got one in mind, Flynn, or do you want us to sort of like throw a few suggestions out to you?
I love the idea. Just throw some at me that you think might suit me.
The Raiders.
Any ideas there? The Raiders?
They're a team.
You do like to drop the old Arabic phrase, don't you?
Yeah. So maybe I love it.
Maybe
the
Bengalis.
Yeah.
Even though they're not Arabic.
But... Racism from Tommy Howes is cancelled. Second episode. Dropping it for months, to be fair.
It's super far away from any Arabic-speaking places, but yeah, we'll go for Bengal.
Should we go for the Bengalis? Yeah.
Well, do you prefer hot or cold climates?
I'll go for hot climates, yeah.
All right, and do you like birds or do you like land predators?
Land predators.
All right, so it's going to be cat. It's going to be hot. Who is it, Tommy? Jacksonville Jaguars. It's got to be in it. In Florida.
From up the bum.
Urban Meyer from up
there. Oh, and it's the finger in the ass guy. Sold. All right, Jacksonville Jaguars. I'll follow them. All right, cool.
Absolutely cemented. And then you can tell that story whenever somebody asks you why you follow Jacksonville Jaguars.
What do we call ourselves, us fans of the Jacksonville Jaguars?
I'm not actually sure, man. I know that the Green Bay Packers call themselves Cheeseheads, and me and Jim was trying to figure that out when we had that on the podcast a few months ago.
To be fair, I'd also like to second that notion. What do the Atlanta Falcons fans call themselves? Because I don't know. I don't remember their team name, let alone the fans' team name.
The Hawks. I think it's the Hawks. Yeah. I might be wrong about that, though.
The Shite Hawks.
It's just some other bird.
Yeah.
All right, so the Jacksonville Jaguars, their mascot is Jackson DeVille. I don't know what that is. It's some like, yeah, it looks like a guy that's dressed up as a tiger, Jackson DeVille. That's a bit weird. But team nicknames, the Jags or Saxonville from 2017. They must have got a lot of sacks that year, I guess. But that's pretty much it. They play in sort of like a teal colour, a black and a gold. And the Atlanta Falcons, Freddie the Falcon or Freddie Falcon is their mascot. Their team nicknames are the Dirty Birds.
Yes, love that.
Or Grits Blitz, which would have been their 1977 defense.
Dirty Birds is a nickname I can get behind all day long.
Dirty Birds. Like, so there you go, Atlanta Falcons. Yeah.
So do you want to move on to the top five things you might have missed?
Let's do it because you've got most of these, haven't you?
Yeah, and I'm interested to hear one in particular. So we'll start off with number one, Talia Crawford. I've seen this last week when I was taking the break at work, 8:30 in the morning, on the toilet at Royal Mail, allegedly. And this popped up in my feed and it really cheered me up in the morning because I thought it was just next level. So Talia Crawford, the 7-year-old daughter of 3-weight world champion Terence Crawford, lost her shoe at the beginning of a 200-meter race last weekend, then came back to absolutely squash the rest of the field. It's pretty amazing to watch. And I couldn't help feeling this was the perfect example of a naturally occurring unfair advantage in sport. Thoughts, Bissett? What do you think of this one?
I see what you're trying to do. You're just trying to rile up that PED chat, aren't you? It's fucking...
Well, there's no better place to have it. You didn't want it. You didn't want it in the group chat. You know, you wanted to enjoy whatever evening that was when we said it. Yeah. Oh, listen, if they know how fast this girl can run, there's no way she should be in against the rest of those seven-year-olds. She was about to lap them, man. She should be racing middle schoolers, man. She may as well be on the steads. I don't know what you, the rest of you boys think. I mean, she might be on the steads, to be fair. I've never seen someone lose their shoe and then come back and win the race. So you'd have to let me know if it's naturally occurring.
Is what it is, mate. Is what it is. She's just clearly better than the competition. She's put in a lot of hard yards over her seven-year life. That's got her to that point. Do you know what I mean? So that's all I can say for her.
And she is the daughter of a top, top level athlete. He's going to have brought her up with, you know, fitness and in mind and studs in a breakfast.
Yeah, that's the thing, man. I'm just trying to say that her advantage naturally is equivalent to the studs, man. So what's the problem? You know what I mean? I can see Bissett is not about to be drawn out here. He's refusing to be drawn into this. Look, he's just shaking his head there. Tommy, what do you think, man? Is this equivalent to studs or not?
Oh, obviously, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely equivalent to studs.
See, Tommy, that's why you've been such a good addition to the show.
Nah, but to be fair, I think I was gonna bring something up in the NFL section because DeAndre Hopkins has been put on a 6-month ban. A 6-week ban for PEDs. And it brings to the conversation, what is a performance-enhancing drug? Because you've got caffeine. You know what I mean? Should caffeine be banned? If you're saying that every substance that gives you any sort of advantage over your field is a performance-enhancing drug, then where do you draw the line? Like, I'm not...
Stop it, Tommy. Just don't, because we just do not want to have this conversation with Jim. You don't. Nah, honestly, because we don't...
I asked him. Don't censor him, Bissett.
Once again, disgusting that... A guy has got a 6-week ban for taking performance enhancing drugs. And then you got a next man who like had a few cheeky bets on his team and got like a year ban. Who was it? It was another wide receiver.
Calvin Ridley.
Yeah. So there you go. Like what is that all about? Like it just shows you where the NFL's what the NFL's stance is on things, man. Shows you what their moral compass looks like, man.
But also the proliferation of PEDs. And do you know what I mean? If they banned everyone that had some sort of form of PED, who'd be playing? I mean, I'm not saying that they're all on it, but it's clearly prevalent within the game.
Yeah, who were you talking about before? He was like a bit slender and then they put him in the gym and then in the off-season he came back just jacked up. Like
Wilson.
Yeah, he's... Listen, I think it would be like you say, Bissett, that's definitely not fair. Someone having a wager, getting a year ban, and someone doing PEDs, depending on what your views on PEDs are, that's not a level playing field. But I've said it a long time. Like I do equivocate like natural levels of performance enhancing to PEDs being at the top end. But I don't want to belabor the point because I can see you're withdrawing into your own mind right now. I'm not going to convince you. So
no, look, at the end of the day, I'm all for it if it's allowed for everybody in it. I'm just all about equality of outcome in it. So basically, if everybody's allowed to do it, then it's absolutely fine. If no one's allowed to do it, then like everyone that does do it needs to be banned or kicked out of the sport forever. You need to have harsh lines when you're talking about this stuff, or just make it legal for everybody to do. That's it.
Isn't that equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome?
Perhaps, yeah.
Tommy's roasting you after you tried to censor him, Bissett. Unreal.
I know. Took some of my points out from the NFL section. That was supposed to be twice as long.
No, we'll move on. But to be fair, Flynn, before you got on, you had a tag team partner, man. Bissett was on the Pure Company, man, vibes. I'm sad we didn't record that bit. But what's your view on this, Flynn? Equality of opportunity or outcome or steads or no steads?
I was just trying to look up how USADA defines PEDs. Tommy talking about caffeine got me thinking about it, but I couldn't find anything. So I missed, what was the debate about the equality of opportunity?
Bissett was basically saying that everyone should be allowed to do steads or no one should be allowed to do steads. And anyone who does do them, in the latter example, should be banned. This deserves more time than space one on the top five things you may have missed. I think I feel like I've created a monster.
I'd say I'll put this to bed and we'll move on. Two weight classes, basically a two division sort of thing. The Stead division, the Natty division. Then.
Sold. The Natty Dread division.
There you go. You just completely solved PEDs in sport.
There you go. They do listen to us, the big dogs in sport. So that will basically get changed in the next few months, I reckon. So answer number two. And this little snippet got the Game of Thrones theme music playing in my head. I saw an interview with Jose Mourinho praising Eddie Howe for the work he's doing at Newcastle. Apparently, Mourinho developed an affection for the Geordies during his time under Bobby Robson in 99. But after a patchy few seasons, albeit having reached a third-tier European Cup final with Roma this year, does the special one have his eyes on the Newcastle war chest? Because those riches make the Chelsea fortunes of its heyday look like the bloodstained fivers from your last Coke session. So can we see the resurgence of the special one? Conspiracy theory or not, building seven, tower seven, I can see Jose Mourinho going to Newcastle. Is that an outrageous idea?
No, that is mad level chess moves, that is, isn't it? Like, this geezer is playing the game at a high level. Do you know what I mean? In terms of like moving those pieces around, just putting in that little word, you know, just getting the juices flowing of a potential return. And he's just going to fucking like chop everyone's head off, isn't he? Definitely.
Could you see it happening though? And like Tommy, yeah, Flynn, anyone, open.
For sure, I can see that happening. Because look, let's say, I don't know, four, maybe five season time, they're going to be up there with Man City and Liverpool for sure. And he's smart enough to know that. He's definitely making some inroads there, I think.
Yeah, so my brother told me that when Mourinho joined a few different teams, he always had a clause in his contract that if the Manchester United job ever came up, he would be free to apply for it, which does show that sort of chess mentality, Game of Thrones, like he's always thinking a few steps ahead. So I wouldn't put it past him that kind of he's dropping the seed, he's getting his name associated with it before he's even, yeah, actually having an interview. He's commenting on the situation so that people start to associate his name with the position. Another interesting aside, actually, is I was told that when Roman Abramovich was coming over to England, so Mourinho's previous owner, when he was coming over to England to buy a football team, he was actually on his way to Newcastle United, but he flew over Stamford Bridge and decided to stop off there and see what was going on there. Now, I don't know if that's just complete bullshit, but I thought it's quite interesting considering now the Newcastle job that might be coming up for him.
Full circle, Tommy. How's with the knowledge, man? And that does sound like the kind of thing... Sorry, it's my dog skittering along the floor. You're going to have to just edit this bit out. I have to let this fucker out. Sorry, man. One second.
Should we just do number three for him?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Former world darts champion Ted Hanky Panky has been jailed for 2 years for sexually assaulting a woman in Cheshire last September. 2 years caught on camera, and the guy got 2 years, which is absolutely shocking. So we're talking about 6 week bans. Like 2 years for a sexual assault seems like a pretty, doesn't seem like a very hefty sentence, does it? So the report isn't specific to the extent of the offence, but it does say he pinned her down, which is pretty damning, to be honest. So he will have to spend 10 years on the sex offenders register. But as you say, like 2 years just ain't enough. If he dodged a million tax, he'd be doing a 10 stretch. So as you say, like Jim's, when he comes back, oh, he's back now. But yeah, for sure, Jim, I completely agree with that one.
Yeah, when this first came up, I wasn't aware of the severity of the situation. And I was calling him Ted Hanky Panky for, you know, comedic reasons. But it's pretty dark what he was doing. And if it wasn't for the attack getting caught on camera, like I was speaking to India about this, he's like, the woman wouldn't have had a leg to stand on. And even then, they were trying to talk it up as if, yeah, we take all these situations seriously. Like 2 years is not enough. And we've seen this. I don't know if it's... I'll tell you what, I'll put it out to you guys. Do you think there is a higher instance of this kind of behaviour from, so like famous sports people? We saw recently with Mason Greenwood, that kind of situation. We've talked in the past about UFC, NFL players and their propensity for domestic violence, etc. Do you think that the ego driven side of sports lends itself to this kind of entitled behavior towards women in particular?
Steads, mate.
Yeah, obviously steads.
Because you'd think like dudes who are into boxing and MMA, you'd think that they tend to be a bit more violent. But then what you often hear is they get a lot of that aggression out during sparring and things like that. So they're usually quite chilled for the rest of the day. And same if you were doing any other sort of high impact sport, like you footballing or running or cycling all day, you kind of just, I don't know, it seems to me like you get a lot of that pent up aggression out. But if you're smashing the steads all the time and you're getting into mad rages, then yeah, maybe that sort of plays a role. But then on the other side of it, maybe we're just hearing more about, it seems like there's more sexual assault in sports because these are like, these are in the public eye already. And we're just kind of getting that sort of, I don't know if it's confirmation bias, would you call it? Where just because we're seeing more cases like that, because it's in the news, because they're in the public eye, we're just assuming that everyone in sports is a rapist.
every single one of them. But it's like high-powered business people having that kind of entitlement. They're used to having the status. They're used to having a certain amount of deference showed towards them. That's got to offset reasonable expectations in terms of your interactions with other people. I wouldn't want to condemn all sports people. Well, we're talking about sports men, really, aren't we? But I wouldn't dismiss a link outright, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, solid point. Yeah, 100%. That ego boost, that entitlement. Yeah, I get what you're saying completely.
We'll move on to... fucking hell. I've fucked up my own rhythm there, pressing mute on and off. We'll move on to number four, something more lighthearted for the NFL files. Fox have announced the hand egg ball goat, Tom Brady. That's a handful. Tom Brady will be joining the network as its lead NFL analyst in a deal set to earn our Tom $375 million over 10 years. Now, if he can string two sentences together, he's the perfect man for the job. But that deal is monstrous. And for commenting on what players with a fraction of his talent and dedication are doing, bank balance check, ego boost again, double check. It's comparable to what most active NFL players earn. Is this the perfect step forward for Tom Brady, staying involved with the sport, enlightening the rest of us into his magical ways? I imagine Michael Jordan would have been perfect, you know, in the same type of deal. What do you guys think? Are you happy to see him still involved, or would you rather him just, you know, take a back seat?
Yeah, I think it would be good to hear what he's got to say on a commentary level. Something that, well, when you talk about big money moves, something that's interesting about Tom Brady, and I've heard said quite a lot, is he's always accepted lower contracts, like lower value contracts, in order that the team around him can build and so that they can add to their pieces. So basically, a team has a maximum salary cap that they can spend on players. And that's the limit that they can offer in contracts to the, what is it, 63 or 53 rostered players. So Tom Brady has had the mind that actually I'd rather reduce my earnings during a season so that the people around me are going to be more likely to bring me a Super Bowl. And that's been some of the criticism that's been laid at Tom Brady's feet. He's good, but he's been with a great manager and he's always had great pieces around him. But he's laid the foundation for that to be possible. So now if he's going and getting his payday, good luck to him, man.
And he's also getting paid. I think they were saying basically a similar amount in 10 less years than he was in his NFL career. Obviously, his NFL career spanned, 20-odd years now. Still going to have at least one more season. But we're assuming that this is going to be his last season. He's probably going to go and take this broadcasting contract. That'll be, $375 million over 10 years. He's probably going to do, 21, 22 games a season, 17 regular games. And then this is with Fox, isn't it? So I do feel that he's ideal for the target audience that they are looking to attract as well. I mean, I don't think you're going to see an ex quarterback going to get this sort of money anywhere near, not in the near future, not in the next sort of 20 years, probably, if ever. I mean, I think they were saying that Tony Romo's on half of what Tom Brady's getting or something. And I mean, let's be quite frank. Let's address the elephant in the room. Like, if he wasn't a good looking white man, would, like, has that benefited the fact that he's getting this amount of money? Right, he is one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time. But if you look at Tony Romo, same sort of shit, ain't it? I can't see a Russell Wilson or Deshaun Watson, or probably definitely not Deshaun Watson, and with what he's got on his back. But you know the point I'm trying to make as well, don't you?
That's bang on. He's the great white hope, isn't it? Sorry, Tommy, but he is that. He's the most relatable figure.
But Deshaun Watson's got in his back is a £200 million contract. So if we're talking about money, he's absolutely gone to town on the old check. But I just wonder if Brady's got, like, is it like a standard NFL player contract where there's like guaranteed money and then there's performance-based money? Has he got to say a certain amount of words per minute in order to activate some of the...
imagine.
Some of the bonuses.
He's like, that was good. Next clip. Yeah, that was sweet. Next clip.
I think he's... they were talking about this a lot on ESPN, and like, I think he's the lead NFL analyst as well. So he's not like, he's not going to be like, a bit part sort of commentary, like supplement to what's going on. He's going to be the lead NFL analyst. So he's going to have a lot of work when it comes to that, I think.
Yeah, that seems mad, to be fair. Coming out as a player, like from a player, it's a completely different thing. Obviously,
we don't know what you have.
Leadership qualities, but to then go into the broadcasting world and be expected to be a lead analyst, I can't even bloody say that
analyst, but yeah. And because Michael Kay, who's he's on, he does the Yankees, he calls the Yankees game, and these guys who are all broadcasters, they were sort of like talking about it a lot this week, and they were just saying like, look, he might be, you know, the greatest like NFL player we've ever seen. But as you say, it's completely different set of skills coming over to broadcast and analyzing things on the fly, and being able to like, you know, put your words together in a way that makes sense to the public. So dilute it slightly to the people, for the people that are listening that perhaps haven't got the sort of same level of technical ability that he has and like the way he sees things, but also being able to make sure that you're not stumbling over your words and stuff when you're on live television. It's fucking difficult, man. It's going to be a completely different scenario for him. And for them to just throw this money at him, I think it's madness, to be honest. I can't believe he's managed to broker this deal. Fair play to him and fair play to his agent. That's all I can say. Right, should we do number five? Yeah. So Northampton Town in the Football League will lodge an official complaint to the EFL after they feel Scunthorpe United compromised the integrity of the league by fielding 7 teenagers in a crucial game against Bristol Rovers. Scunthorpe subsequently got beat 7-0 by Bristol Rovers, which was the exact amount that Joey Barton's men needed to leapfrog the Cobblers into the automatic promotion spots. There was like unbelievable scenes in that game, and it was something out of those footy novels that you'd see in the school library. I personally am calling foul on this. What do you lads think? I think there needs to be a sneaky little investigation into this to make sure there wasn't some match fixing.
I'd heard about them needing 7 goals to win the league, and I saw some of the footage of the celebrations, but this is the first I've heard about this. This is super interesting. So what Northampton are suggesting, there was some deal between Scunthorpe and Bristol. So Scunthorpe would bring out 7 teenage kids to play, and then they just got smashed 7-0.
To increase the chances of that move happening. But sounds to me like Joey Barton's just been issuing death threats like he used to do back in the day, punching lads in the chest, elbowing lads in the face. Like, same vibe, isn't it? What do you think?
He's been touted for the Burnley job as well, I think, Joey Barton, which would be horrendous because I absolutely hate the guy.
Do you think he'll put on a fake Northern accent the same way he put on a fake French accent when he went to Marseille?
100%.
Because it's like the ball and the media. And what the fuck are you talking about, Joey? That regularly comes up on cringe compilations that I watch.
Major.
And every time. It makes my toes curl every time, man.
But what are the chances? You always see it, don't you? Oh, like a team, like, you know, even if they win, if the other team win, then, you know, they can't get promoted. They're going to drop into the playoffs because there's no way they're going to overturn a 7-goal deficit. But they actually did it this time. It could just be that, you know, that the stars aligned. But how often do you see 7-0 wins and then it happened to happen? But that it's the circumstances behind it. They needed exactly 7 goals. I don't know, man. I smell a rat, to be honest.
Nah, 9/11 was not an inside job, mate. No way.
And it's the problem of society today, and everything's a conspiracy.
But the thing is, everything is actually a conspiracy, so that's where you kind of fucked.
Moving on swiftly to number 6.
Chemtrails have been spotted above. a sneaky little number 6. I thought I'd slip this one in there. And this is from IGM.com. So after almost 30 years, EA Sports and FIFA are parting ways, and EA will chart a new future under the name EA Sports FC. So aside from the name change, the lack of a licensing deal means that there could be some changes to the tried and true FIFA formula. So in an interview with the BBC, EA Sports Vice President David Jackson says that the deal with FIFA wasn't just for the name, but included a set of licensing restrictions that EA no longer has to abide by. So this could free the company up to explore more interactive and fan-focused gameplay content. So what's happening here is EA aren't going to be able to do FIFA games anymore. And then I thought I'd slip this in. It gets brought up on the pod quite a bit about FIFA goals.
Yeah, it's better. This is better because how formulaic has FIFA been over the past couple of years? I stopped playing FIFA 18. It was just the game was regressing. I've played one or two games ever since. It's the same as it was nearly 10 years ago with minor alterations. They're not even improvements. I think the product's been stale for a long time. I think that Konami led the way in terms of re-franchising, rebranding Pro Evolution Soccer, which we were like big players of back in the day, moving it into a free game, trying to be a little bit more inventive, intuitive. Now, their game got slated, and only in a recent update has it been basically a playable game. And EA do run the risk of that kind of thing. If they overhaul their whole system, there's going to be some teething problems. But I think this is basically a positive step for the franchise. EA put it to bed. This has been happening in gaming a lot, man. Like Call of Duty and stuff, they're putting that to bed. Battlefield, that's going to bed. Good signs for me in this particular instance because FIFA's been dead for time. Bissy, you look angry, man. You're right.
Yeah, no, Simon, I was just agreeing with you in my head, Jim. I think it did need a shake up, doesn't it? I haven't played FIFA for quite a long time now. I was saying in the group, wasn't I? I think the thing that was carrying FIFA was the Ultimate Team. I think that seems to be the most popular format in both of those games. I think Pro Evo tried to do something similar, didn't they? I think they tried to replicate that kind of model. I don't think it really worked. I don't really know anyone apart from Tom Hardy that has played Pro Evo in the last sort of like 5 years. So I think that's what you're talking sort of. That's the target audience, isn't it?
How about you, Tommy? Are you a Football Manager pro or FIFA guy, if you ever get the time?
To be honest, I haven't played one of those football games for 10 years, man. Pro or FIFA. I think FIFA's a cash cow, isn't it? They're guaranteed to sell millions of copies and make tons of money, regardless of the quality of the game. And it doesn't give them much impetus to really want to develop it. Like, that's me talking from having not played probably for the last 5 years, 6 years plus. But that's just, yeah, the way that I look at that sort of industry, to be honest.
Nothing's changed in the last 5-6 years, mate.
Yeah, if it ain't broken, you know, why fix it?
Even if it is broken and you're getting shitloads of cash, don't worry about it. Sweet, isn't it?
Well, should we do the feature fights, yeah?
Yeah, let's do it, man. We'll start with the retrospective. You guys can all check out my my live watch-along from UFC 274 and Canelo versus Bivol last weekend. I won't go into too much detail. Did you guys catch the fights, or was this... I know I'm getting the feeling Flynn has. What about you, Bissett, and you, Tommy? Did you guys catch the UFC or the boxing?
Yeah, I was bouncing back between the UFC and the boxing. Luckily, the Bivol-Canelo fight, when it was on live, was during the Esparza-Rose Namajunas fight, which was horrific. So it was quite an easy flick back. Every time I flick back to the Rose, Carla, Esparza, it looked like both fighters were just in sort of like what do you call it? What's that called in a gaming term?
Street Fighter.
No, just like in
practice mode and fight.
Practice mode, yeah, like. Yeah, I mean, not moving, not throwing anything. So, and the missus, like, I always, you know, obviously we're in the house, and I'm always like saying, "Oh, there's a massive fight this weekend." She always texts me, so like every weekend it's a big fight. But she was watching with me, and every time I flicked it back to the UFC, she was like, "Oh," and I put the boxing back on. Like she was actually really wanting to watch, because I'll give her a bit of context about the fight, and you know, Canelo like being basically like the best pound fighter around at the minute, and he was stepping up a division to challenge this guy who, you know, all right, it wasn't like a, you know, nobody was really sure where he was in terms of his ability, you know, in the bigger stage. I think like people like Jim, who follow quite religiously the boxing, will know how good he was. But I didn't know how good he was. And to be honest, watching Bivol, he really endeared me to him, man. Everything about him, like his performance, the manner, his discipline in the fight. When, you know, I think he was like super fast hands, like incredibly fast hands. And then Canelo, when he sort of like maybe had a through four or five punch combination, and Canelo was just like baiting him on, saying like, "Come on, then." He just kept his cool, man. Kept his composure, and I think that just made he basically chose the right tactics to make sure that the fight was like always in his corner, man. And like he was always on the front foot. The ball was always in his court, and I just thought it was a fantastic performance, man. What probably one of the best boxing performances I've seen in a long time, man, if ever.
You said it was your new favourite fighter, didn't you?
For sure.
Which is saying a lot, because it's easy to let the big occasion overawe you, especially against a fighter like Canelo. But like, I'll get my my scorecard up, because a lot of the pundits since, or the ones that I listen to at least, have been very critical of the official scorecards. I'll be honest, the first six rounds, I had it like nip and tuck, really. I had it like Canelo, I thought, was landing the bigger, more like flashy punches, power punches. But then Bivol would be tucked up nice and tight, and then he'd throw in phases, like one, two, three, step back. Then he'd go again. And sometimes the combinations will keep building and building and building. And then as Canelo looked for more power shots, Bivol would up his volume. And Canelo wasn't really getting through with anything, wasn't really putting a dent. And he cut quite a casual figure for me. I thought it was, in part, it's a bit of an arrogant performance from him. He looked like he was just willing to close the distance with a bit of a flicking jab, then drive in the power shots and just expected Bivol to wilt. But that's not what happened at all. One second, I'm just getting up my scorecards now.
Yeah, there wasn't much variance in his approach, was there, Canelo?
No, I didn't think so. But just to get a perspective on how I scored the fight, I gave Bivol the first. I gave Canelo the next three. So that just shows you where I was at that point. But then I gave Bivol the next four rounds, gave Canelo one more round, then I gave Bivol the last three. So one of my questions going into this fight was, would Bivol be able to adjust? Because that's what Canelo does so well. He has a look at you for the first two rounds, and then he starts identifying your weaknesses. Then he starts going to work on you. I feel like he established a pattern for himself quite early in this fight. And I think Bivol did quite a magnificent job of turning the tide at a crucial stage in the fight. And I had it 116, 112 to Bivol by the end, retains his WBA light heavyweight championship. And now they're talking the rematch. I don't know if Canelo is going to take that.
Why would he want to take that? I said that to Tina in the group. I was like, why would he want that rematch? Because to be honest, and you might be able to tell me where Canelo might be able to change his game plan. But I don't see how he'd be able to get back in the ring with him and expect to beat him. And Tina was like, I think he'll take it. Why? Why would you want to take it?
The thing about Canelo is my view of him is he's like one of those psychopathic winners. And even though he cut quite a casual figure for me, quite an arrogant figure, like throwing big punches and dropping his hands, then allowing Bivol to come back at him, I feel like he'll watch that and I feel like he'll adjust the same way he adjusted between the Golovkin fight first and second. I think he's got a bigger problem on his hands with Bivol because their styles clash horribly for Canelo, really. He's not big enough to really hurt him. He hasn't got the gas tank to stay with him down the stretch. His aura isn't affecting Bivol. It's, for me, in in slightly different ways. It's a little bit similar dynamic to AJ and Usyk. You know, I mean, AJ's more limited than Canelo, but in terms of personality and in terms of earning potential and all that stuff, there's definitely parallels there. But for the UFC, quickly over the results, Carla Esparza dethroning Rose Namajunas in one of the worst fights I've ever seen. The less said about that, the better, because that was horrendous.
What do you think about the decision, though?
I was shocked. I was shocked, to be honest.
I don't know what... I know there was a lot of criticism with Rose. Obviously, her moniker, Thug Rose. She didn't look like a thug at all in that matchup with Carla Esparza. But mind you, I don't think Esparza really did enough to be able to take the title away from her. So I'm not sure what the sort of judges were seeing in that instance. Like, I don't really... It was a difficult one to score, obviously, because not much happened. But surely you have to win the title. You don't lose the title. Somebody has to win it rather than losing it.
I don't go along for that logic, to be fair. I feel like it's round by round. As soon as the bell rings, that title is up for grabs. It's not around anyone's waist, you know. I mean, obviously, big personality fighters enjoy that advantage, but that's not really the case. I would prefer it to be as objective as possible. My impression of the fight when it ended was that Rose had won, but, you know, Carla Esparza was the only one attempting anything aggressive. Rose was literally posturing, fainting, going in and out. So frustrating, because you could see she had the positioning and the distance and the speed. Yeah. And it was so, so frustrating.
Good for Zhang Weili, though. I feel like, I think if Zhang Weili beats Joanna Jędrzejczyk, she'll probably get the chance at Carla Esparza, maybe.
Yeah, things have opened wide for everyone else, because Rose has dusted everyone else, hasn't she? And Michael Chandler, Mr. Miyagi, Tony Ferguson into the Twilight Zone after a tough first round to get back to winning ways. And probably relegating Ferguson from title contention for good. I wonder what's going to happen to his career now. But Michael Chandler, how exciting is he, man? Win, lose or draw. He just does something. He makes things happen. Calling out McGregor and Gaethje and Oliveira all after his win. Fair play to him. Getting in there into the UFC in his mid-30s, making it happen for himself. And in the main event, Charles Oliveira losing his lightweight title by a half a pound on the scales. No longer the champion. Only Justin Gaethje was eligible for the belt. Well, it didn't really make a difference, because he got on his back and he choked him out in the first round. Charles Oliveira is on an untouchable run at the minute. He's absolutely frightening at the minute.
I keep betting against him. I love him and I hate him. His skill set is just incredible compared to anyone else in the division. And that's the most stacked division in the whole sport, for me at least anyway. And I keep betting against him every single time. And then he keeps beating guys quicker every single time. And it's even gotten to the point where I don't even think Islam could handle him anymore. I was sure Islam would smoke him, and I'm pretty sure he's up next. But I think he'll choke out Islam too. What do you reckon?
You know what the interesting thing about this, I think him as a fighter is, he gets this 5-second grace period that no other fighter in the UFC gets, is when he gets knocked down, he gets 5 or 6 seconds to be able to lie on the deck, because no cunt wants to get on the ground with him, man, because he's that dangerous. Like, when you get on the ground with him, it's basically like the fight's over, and it's getting to that point where you just cannot deal with him. And, you know, Justin Gaethje was like, he was seconds away from winning that fight as well, wasn't he, really? Like, he looked in trouble. That he got knocked down twice, Oliveira, and then obviously Oliveira had the knockdown, and then that was it. Justin Gaethje showed him his back, and then you know what happens with Charles Oliveira in those situations.
Mate, the second knockdown that Gaethje scored, it looked like Oliveira was really hurt. It cut him. It was a delayed action knockdown. And then you see him just revert into that open guard, and Gaethje didn't want any part of it, walked back. And you're right, Bissett, it gives him an extra 5 seconds, which that's crucial when your fitness is on that level, when you're tough enough anyway. You're in the championship fight. Every single breath is absolutely crucial. And the way he landed that right hand, and Gaethje just went flying. And you never normally see that from him. He's usually got a cast iron chin. I'm going to fucking murder this dog if he doesn't stop moving around. Get in your bed, man. Yeah, so as soon as Oliveira got onto the ground and you saw the choke was a little bit low, He just latched onto his arm, isolated that with a triangle. Then Gagey scrambled to get up because that's all he could do. And Oliveira just slept onto his back, man. Just sunk in the choke, readjusted straight up. You knew it was over as soon as his elbow went under the chin. I don't know who's going to beat this guy. In the next two or three fights, I think he's got two or three fights left in him when he's looking pretty untouchable, man. After that, we might see a bit of a dip. And he's like half blind as well. Like he wears glasses. When he's in the octagon, he says he sees three people and he hits the one in the middle. You think that's mental?
That's nuts, isn't it?
He's amazing.
Did you see Gage's reaction said it all as well? Like the camera cut to him after he tapped out and then he got up onto his feet. Like he was just like, fuck. Like just dejected, like fuck's sake. He's like, it's kind of like he knew that he couldn't get into that situation, but he had like, there's nothing he could do about it. It wasn't like, and I don't think he was like bewildered by what happened. He was just like, I knew that's the only thing I couldn't do was like, you know, get decked onto the floor and then, you know, show his back and get put into that position. But he was just like, oh, for fuck's sake.
It's extra galling because that's what happened to him against Khabib as well. Like, you know what I mean? Put to sleep. You know you can't get taken down. If you get taken down, you're fucked. Oh, I just got took down. Screw it, man.
And he did it in about, I think, less than half the time it took Khabib to do it to Gagey. It was incredible. And I saw a clip recently of Chandler versus Oliveira. And do you remember that? Do you remember Chandler getting out of a locked-in rear naked choke from Oliveira? It's amazing. And we didn't see... Gagey had no chance of getting out. Poirier, no chance of getting out. But Chandler, he got out of it really well. And I don't think... We don't talk enough about Chandler's ground game. That was phenomenal, that work that he did. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, but it's like keeping the inevitable at bay. And, you know, Poirier did a good job in those early rounds of fighting off the chokes, but he just kept finding that position, locking onto his waist and just snaking onto his back. Yeah, for me, he's too well-rounded, too tough. The Muay Thai is nasty. The ground game's ridiculous. Charles Oliveira, even if he's not wearing the belt, he's the champion right now and they should market him as such. But in the interest of time, because we're running quite long now, I did have a few results from Bellator. We'll skip past those. We'll go to the look ahead. Bellator are back tonight, actually. They are in London for their 281 show. Michael Venom Page headlining against Logan Storley for the interim welterweight title. The full champion, Larislav Amosov, was pulled from the fight due to the conflict in Ukraine, as has been happening with so many like combat sports athletes over the last few months. Lyoto Machida and Paul Daly also scheduled in separate bouts there. That's tonight. The main card starts at 9 p.m. UK time, which means I've got a decision to make because Lightning, Linu, Udofia and Denzel Bentley are topping the Channel 5 card, which has already started at 7 p.m. So we're awash. We're awash with combat sports on terrestrial TV. What a time to be alive. It's like when you used to get WWF Heat on Channel 4 on a Sunday morning. Am I right, Bissett? It's absolutely astounding. Josh Kelly, Harlem Eubank, Sean Dodd, all on the undercard. Big up to the Sourlands. Those are those half English, half German guys. And one of them's always coked up at press conferences. Up the boys. On Sunday, we see the return of former UFC light heavyweight champion, the Polish power, Jan Blachowicz, taking on 14-2 Alexander Rakic. I've not seen much of Rakic, but this feels like a crucial outing for the former champ. I'd love to see him summon the intensity we saw against Reyes and Adesanya that was sorely lacking in his title loss to Shearer. That was a shock for me, you know.
Huge shock, man.
He got bodied in that fight, man. And as for the boxing on Saturday, we have Jermell Charlo versus Brian Castaño, the rematch for the undisputed super welterweight title. You can't move for undisputed fights these days. I absolutely love it. These two had a split draw last July, and I thought Charlo was quite fortunate to receive that. This fight was postponed in February due to Castaño injuring his shoulder. That could be a factor in this fight. Charlo and his brother have been on the piss at other events in the last few weeks. That could also be a factor. Either way, this should be a good one, and watch out for welterweight Jaron Boots Ennis as main support. He's 28-0, 26 KOs, never been past the sixth round. That kid is an absolute monster. The next couple of years, he's the guy to replace people like Errol Spence and Terence Crawford once they move on. Also, former light heavyweight champion Sergey Kovalev returns for the first time since whooping Canelo, or since getting whooped by Canelo a couple of years ago. He's back in against Tervel Pulev at cruiserweight, and Gilberto Ramirez is in a 12-rounder in Ontario, Canada against Dominic Bozell, which is random, but nowhere near as random as Floyd Mayweather fighting his former sparring partner, Don Moore, on the helipad of the Burj Khalifa, which is actually happening on Saturday. Jim West, Desperada, Rough Rider. What's going on in this sport? It'll make like 50 million from that, I guarantee it. There's an undercard and everything, but that's an exhibition.
I haven't even heard about this. Like, I haven't seen this anywhere. Like, this is the first I've heard of anything like this.
He was meant to fight some YouTuber, but, you know, apparently that fell through because the YouTuber is like some 25-year-old kid with no boxing experience. And he's going to get an exhibition bout against Floyd Mayweather on top of the Burj Khalifa. That seems to be the USP of this event.
What is going on, man? Why is Floyd Mayweather even bothering with this shit? And I don't know why he is, obviously, because he wants to make more money, but he must be either hemorrhaging money at a scary rate, or he just can't get enough of it. It's one of the two, isn't it?
Well, you can't keep putting on 350 grand bets on, like, you know, the Green Bay connoisseurs or whatever every Monday night. You know, he hasn't got another revenue stream that's equaled his purses. It just doesn't happen. He came to England a few months ago, maybe last year, and he was doing like advertisements for restaurants in Bradford, like Manjaro's and that, and selling double glazing windows, anything for a few quid. He's like Trump selling steaks, isn't it?
Weird geezer.
You got to do it, man. You can't keep getting punched in the head. He's killing it. But that's it, man. I think of all the fights over the weekend, I'll be watching the Charlo and Castaño first and foremost.
Yeah,
I'm definitely going to watch the Floyd Mayweather helipad one just for, you know, freak show levels. And as soon as we wrap up here, the boxing or Bellator, what do you think? I feel like the boxing will be like...
Yeah, do the boxing, mate. Yeah, Channel 5.
Yeah, but Michael Venom Page. Yeah, Machida, Kung Fu Kicks, man. Mr. Miyagi in the house. But also, there's Michael Venom Page. He's always good for a few highlight reel knockouts, man. I'm still torn. Still torn a little bit. Flip
dual
a coin.
Screen it, mate. Get one on the TV. Get your laptop out. Put the one on the laptop. There you go.
I don't know, man. I like to actually watch. Like, I don't know if I can dual screen the fights, man. I don't know. But that's it. That's it for the featured fights this week.
And that'll be it for the podcast episode this week. Great to see you again, Liam Flynn. Great to have you back on. And another great performance by Tommy Howes talking about the NFL. We should definitely make this a regular thing, mate.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Tommy, you're welcome back anytime as long as you keep agreeing with my PED stance. So, you know, that's a free ticket through the ball chat door anytime you want, mate.
And me and Flynn can align on our communist values, and then we'll be set.
I'll start reading up on the Jacksonville Jaguars.
That's it. Well, I want a review. I want to, when the season starts in September, I want a weekly review about the Jacksonville Jags, who you thought was the best player, who you thought was where you think they're going to go from here, if they're going to win next week. That's what we need, mate. We've got our NFL teams now.
Shahid Khan has never steered us wrong before, so
no, he hasn't. He'll be all right. And I think he is he not the owner of Fulham as well, Shahid Khan? Is he, Tommy? Is he the owner of Fulham, Shahid Khan?
No idea.
Oh, Tommy, come on, son. You were doing so well.
Here we go. He's the principal owner of Jacksonville Jaguars and Fulham FC, and also the co-owner of All Elite Wrestling.
Flynn!
This is literally your team. Yeah, All Elite Wrestling. He's a co-owner of that as well. Oh, mate, sold. Absolutely sold. He's a weird-looking geezer, isn't he? It looks like he's, I don't know. Definitely All Elite like Wrestling. He's been around like 1,000 years ago, man, during the Crusades.
Did he used to own an F1 team as well? Or am I mixing up mustaches?
Yeah.
Easy done. Easy done.
It's the mustaches you're mixing up, innit? Yeah. All right, we'll leave it there then. Yeah, thanks for listening once again. As always, check us out on the socials, and we will most probably be back again as a four-man unit next week. So lots more chat, lots more ball chat. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.